Get to Old Navy for star-spangled style. Right now, everything's on sale, up to 60% off. That's right, get everything from tees, shorts, dresses, and swim, all at 60% off. Now till July 7th at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Valid through 7/7, select styles only.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rustland, today we have two returnees, festival programmer, and for now, our man at the British Council, Grey Yeo.
Hi, it's good to be back.
And we have the return of former newscaster and playwright and person who's doing a PhD on satire, Anne Lee.
Hi, Cam.
And our three topics this week will be: topic number one is video encyclopedias, topic number two, archives, and finally, topic number three, hope. What is it good for? So, Grey, video encyclopedias.
Yeah, I think video encyclopedias is maybe quite a heavy and overimposing word. But over the last couple of weeks or so, I found myself watching a lot of short videos on Facebook, and specifically videos that were produced by Vox Media, where they attempt to explain several things, like, you know, why do people are attracted to certain things, or there's one that really stood out was the design of the Shinkansen, the bullet train in Japan.
Right. Okay.
The designer was inspired by shapes from birds because his hobby was he liked to look at birds. He's a bird watcher. So a lot of his design of the Shinkansen was based on the shape of the beak of, let's say, the kingfisher. So I found myself just getting addicted watching all these videos.
How short is short?
Not more than 10 minutes,
right,
each of this video. And because Vox Media, they're really, really great at producing this very snappy type of video content.
With lots of graphics.
Lots of videos, interviews. I sort of thought about this new way of communicating,
yeah,
especially when you have quite dense information that you want to convey to a millennial type of target audience who may not necessarily have the patience to read through, like, you know, pages and pages of websites. So going and using video as a medium to attract them and to attempt to educate them in a way was really, really fascinating. You know, these are really interesting topics that I wouldn't have otherwise go and specifically look for on the internet or read books about it. But just opening them and consuming them in bite sizes, I found really fascinating, and I feel, you know, smart, you know, after watching the videos, like tad little bit more intelligent than I used to be.
Yeah. I mean, is this wisdom?
So it's quite good to have a short attention span then, right?
Well, it's a good thing for the videos, but if you don't, I mean, if you have a long attention span, then you can not dip into the videos.
Yeah, so I think one of the things that I found was particularly quite useful for me, at least, because the past couple of weeks I've been really busy. And when I have time, whether I'm cooking or doing laundry and all that, I could just leave the video and I can listen to them like a background podcasting, like I do with a bit of culture podcast. So it's actually quite useful because you suddenly get this kind of passive education in a sense. So I really, really like this, you know, video encyclopedia type of medium.
But is this really knowledge, wisdom, or is it just grazing, getting kind of like general knowledge, which I'm not against, by the way. I mean, I think better culture is based on that. Mm-hmm. So, but if this is all there is, that's just not too good, is it?
No. I feel that rather, because you can choose, right? You can choose what you want to watch, and you can choose to either educate yourself by watching these video encyclopedias, or actually you can just put in a manga series and you watch your anime in the background. But I think the existence of these type of videos, educational videos, and telling you some nugget of really smart, intelligent information is useful.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the video count, and I'm conscious looking at the numbers at the bottom of the screen, how many people have watched it?
It
numbers to millions, you know?
Yeah.
So then you compare, and I started thinking to myself, where if it's an anime, sure, of course it's millions also, but if this is what the young generation, you know, are watching, I have a little bit more positivity,
yeah,
if, you know.
Young kids like Grey Yeo watching. Anne, are you a YouTube, Facebook kind of like dipper into these kinds of forms of knowledge?
Yeah, sure.
You
I mean, you know, yeah. I think half of it though, is, you know, when we talk about like millennials and the way of understanding, part of it is just very different to how I read or learn. I mean, my capacity to read a longer essay versus, you know, like, for example, some sites, they give you the number of words and then how long it takes average to read it, which I find that's so funny. But I think individuals read and consume as they will. But of course, there are different trends as to how you've done that. And there are all sorts of reasons as to, you know, you don't have a lot of time or you have less time or something like that. I mean, how many people would typically watch a Wayang show for 3 days in a row, for example, compared to even 3 hours? The context changes and that's how we learn. But it doesn't mean you learn less. You know, like often you hear sort of, I'm just sort of made that little crack about short attention span as if it's something less than. It's not less than. It's different.
Well, there's a website that I just discovered, which I was thinking of recommending, which is Kings and Generals. I believe that Kings and Generals is actually a video game, and some of the fans of the video game have created a YouTube channel where they do short, maximum 10 minute descriptions of battles, and these are battles that I've read many times over. But when you read them, it says, and then the left wing attacked second corps on the right, and then they burn, and you're trying to picture it in your head, and you've no idea. But actually, when you see their very good graphic descriptions, it's like, oh, now it all makes sense. I mean, I actually do need that visual element to tell me the whole story. Reading is great, of course, but it's not a holistic learning experience. We need vision as much as we need the abstract thought and sound, for that matter.
I remember I watched a Nat Geo documentary about Angkor Wat, and, you know, trying to understand what was so fantastic about the technology at the time. You know, when you're standing there surrounded by, you know, walls of rubble and lots of other tourists wandering around taking selfies, it's kind of hard to imagine what was the great technology. But something like this Nat Geo doco showed you exactly how the water worked in terms of both sort of keeping life within the complex livable, and also in addition to sustaining crops and all the rest of it. And that, you know, there's no taxing on the imagination there. It's really beautiful to see how it all worked. And then that was immediately much more.
And now you know and understand Angkor Wat. And we could ask you any question and you could tell us exactly, couldn't you?
According to this doco, I could. Which is, of course, then you have to watch like 1,000 other docos in order to see whether or not this doco was actually correct.
We're not going to become experts, though, by watching these things. Is that a problem?
No, I don't think so. I think it's one of those, you can consume things. You don't necessarily need to be an expert. Certainly, I watched the video not wanting to be a bird watcher or, you know, black and white color photocolorists. But to know that there are people out there that are doing all these different things, and yeah, it just makes the world more interesting.
Yeah, I personally think that these short things are very good, and they're taking up the slack from television, because what's left on TV are programs about people restoring cars, and that's called history. And so we move on now to top number two, which is Anne Lee, Archives.
Yeah, well, I mean, actually, by happy coincidence, it's kind of connected to what Gray was talking about, and especially I'm noticing when you talk about millennials as well. I think that was a factor which was very important for the launch just a few days ago of two archives presented by Five Arts Center, and they are, I think, perhaps the first archives about performing arts in Malaysia from the private sector. I mean, of course, we have, you know, Arkib Negara or Arsip Nasional in Indonesia, but these two archives, one is called myartmemoryproject.com and the second one is called myartseducationarchive.com. The first one was driven largely by Kathy Rowland, and that's kind of come from her collection of programs. She's just like traveled for the last 20 years with this, you know, these things in her 20-kilo luggage limit. I don't know quite how she did that. But now you can access, from the 1940s through to now, all kinds of information and data relating to performing arts within the country. And I think that is something that's extremely new.
These are digitized and made available.
Yes, yes, right. Yes. The second one is largely driven by Janet Pillay, who has been in arts education for a very long time. And so they have slightly different focuses. The arts education one is on non-formal education. So, you know, things that you did that you didn't do at school, or not that there's that much education necessary at school, but
both are digitized, available online archives.
Yes, yes, for free. It's sponsored by three parties. Okay, one is Yayasan Saim Darbi, the other is Think City, and there's something
Half
which
Moon
is
Bay.
A Half Moon Bay. Yeah, which is
right. See, for me, archives. I mean, I've visited a few archives in my time, and Lee, I'll tell you, and they're places that you go to. You have to travel there physically,
yeah.
And then you go inside and you make an application for the particular file that you want to read. You wait for that file to arrive, and then you read that file 2 hours later and discover it's not the one you wanted.
Yes.
And you start all over again.
Yeah.
But you find all sorts of strange, interesting things in the original form right in front of you, a piece of paper that was written 200-300 years ago right in front of you.
Mm, mm.
That, to me, is an archive, young lady. But I have found that in the age of the internets, you know, archives are now these digitized things, and therefore it allows us to create transnational histories. So in one moment you could be looking at the
Either My Art Memory Project or myartseducationarchive.com.
Wow, yeah, snappy yeah, yeah. names.
I know. It's just kind of like, how to say it. Well, the first one has an elephant, you know, My Art. So that kind of...
All right, so the elephant one. You can check out the elephant one. And then within 3 seconds, you could then be looking at archives from, say, Australia about Australian arts.
If it was franchised somehow, yeah.
No, but you can. I mean, there would be a different website that archives other things, and it's in Australia. And you no longer have to physically travel to the archives in order to find out this information.
Yeah. Actually, at the launch, Janet Pillay talked quite extensively around how the sort of the whole process of what goes into...
So unprofessional. Someone just... Anne Lee.
Sorry.
Carry on.
So she was talking about how... Because there is, like a ideology even around how you develop an archive and what goes into it, because of course that will form the basis of what could be an official history or unofficial histories or whatever. So, and it's the second part about it is what's the sort of protocol by which you go through to find the information, because Google, you just Google the one word for whatever it is and you will get 100 million sources. How can you usefully get into it? So you have to, whatever is the archive, whether it's digital or physical, you have to learn the protocol. So they were talking about it and discussing it with the web designer as to how should they do it that would accommodate both people who are used to reading long articles and are going in to find information in a sort of, let's call it a classic way, and the way which is more so-called millennial bullet point, shorter, sharper things, because you're never going to read a whole article that's like 15,000 words, you know. So how to break it up in ways that are interesting.
The information architecture, the design of the structure of the website, how you access information, all this comes into play. And especially when, some people might just research and look for information in a very scholarly manner. But also at the same time, you have young people who are more interested in bite-sized information. They just want to look at images. They just want to look at the digitized program or posters just for the sake of looking at the aesthetics, how aesthetics of performing arts changed from the 1940s to today. What are the similarities or what are the big differences?
If you look for it, how many plays have there been done about, homosexuality, for instance?
Yeah.
You can type it in and find out.
Find out. We seem to be painting a picture that we have to create everything for people who have an attention span of 3 minutes before they then keel over and say, I can't even. I think that if somebody's wanting to get into an archive about Malaysian arts, they're already capable.
Yeah, but I think rather than coming across as patronizing, I know that it may sound patronizing, but I'm looking at it from a perspective of being inclusive. So if you are thinking that there are people, like you said, who are interested in, you know, Malaysian performing arts for that matter, or even some kind of other subjects that they're interested in, I'm sure there are people who are interested from different perspectives. Like I said earlier, I might be interested, because I'm more of a visual person, I might be interested in the posters and the aesthetics. And another person, young people maybe, who are more interested in the text or the subject matter or the issue. So I think the website or the archives itself is designed to cater to, you know, a variety of different people.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure about that. I think that an archive is an archive. It's a repository for information. It's not really the job of the archive to then sell the stuff that's in there. I think other people then go to the archive. I mean, I go to archives, and it is then my job to seek out what I want and to then write something, create something, to then sell that to people, to make that then interesting.
I think that's because you have a specific, you're very clear about what you want. If someone said, hey, you know, go over there, there's a whole bank of information and data, all that you ever wanted to know, that's not necessarily going to be as stimulating or as, you know, the idea of, for example, of I don't know, the last physical archives I was in was the National Archives in, British Museum. They have changing exhibitions about what is in the archives there, because there's so much, you don't know how to access it.
Yeah, but that's the world's second largest archive. It's got everything about the British Empire. You know, people go there to get whatever you want after the Library of Congress in Washington. Something like a Malaysian arts thing, it's not under any pressure, I believe, to get a million hits. I mean, you go to the National Archives in Malaysia, there are like five people there any given day, and that's pretty damn good. That's okay.
Yeah, so what are we saying? We're saying that actually it's the more people who would be interested in the history of something or in creating, finding out more information, this is now available.
Yes.
And, for example, I mean, reviews, which hopefully we see the end of just reviews that call themselves reviews, are just kind of descriptions of the action that happens without any kind of historical context, without any kind of either, you know, no history around the performers, no history around the content or anything like that. This hopefully would be an option to help people to be able to have
absolutely
write in a way that's informative and entertaining.
Exactly. And then I would worry that if the archive would then go and measure itself by the amount of hits that it gets, that it would be then feel itself to be a failure. But it is a success because it is there, and it is then for others to go there. I mean, if they can create content which then attracts people, then that's fine. But it shouldn't feel that it's failed if it doesn't get a million hits.
Well, it probably
and I hope that its sponsors don't feel that that would be the thing.
Apparently, it'll be free, so.
Yeah, and I hope that the sponsors would feel continuously happy forever. Because it's there. It's fantastic.
And then we'll have like archives about Malaysian water, Malaysian peace, Malaysian...
Yeah, well, I mean, and Joe Kidd, who some of you may know, one of the doyens of the punk scene, he's creating an archive on the punk scene in Malaysia, and it's going to be huge and fabulous. And I think everybody should be doing their part to create this little museum. Anyway, we move on, though. And in a moment, we move on to the topic number three, which will be hope. What is it good for? Here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Grey Yo, and Anne Lee. And now, topic number three, episode four, A New Hope, What Is It Good For? I was watching a very bad movie the other day called Wrath of the Titans. It had, like, humans, ancient Greek humans, and them interacting with gods, ancient Greek gods. And so one of the humans says about humans, you know, humans are great because we have hope when there is no hope. We have belief in things when there is nothing to believe. And I was thinking, that's a pretty feeble argument. But anyway, it's the kind of thing that Bones says to Spock all the time in Star Trek, you know, we can believe in these things. And it also is a sort of thing that Barack Obama based his original campaign on, was hope, change, yes, we can, all those happy things. And shortly afterwards, the numbskull Sarah Palin said, very dismissively, but I think very accurately, you know, how's your hopey changey thing going, Barack? Because ultimately, it's a sort of emptiness, and we now, I believe, live in an age.
What a nihilist. Well, what do you mean, ultimately, it's emptiness?
Because we live in an age with, not just internationally in America with Trump, but here locally in Malaysia, where hope has been well, I would say one defeated, but been replaced by less abstract words. So in the case of America, you have make America great again, mm-hmm. where it's full of verbs. I mean, I would say that America is a verb, whereas hope is much more abstract, conceptual, and it's being crushed. And I wonder if we, as every sports fan knows, it's the hope that gets you. Mm-hmm. When you go to watch your football team and they fail, but if you went there with any hope, you will be disappointed. But if you go there with no hope, then you won't be disappointed.
You wouldn't be there in the first place.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you just have your allegiance and you just go and you... But you, what if you supported a team which will always fail? You know it. They're so bad, they're always going to fail. What do you do? So I'm wondering if hope is something that we've been selling ourselves for a long time as being a good thing when actually it leads you possibly down paths of disappointment. And we should replace that with realism. Mm. I mean, are you hopey-changey people?
Well, in this season of hope, I am a hopey-changey person, yes. Yeah. At the very least, because without hope, we wouldn't have despair.
Okay. It's good to have the lows as much as the highs, is what you're saying?
You know, these are aspects. If you think about, I mean, that whole lovely cliche of the glass half full or half empty, I think this is a question which is asking around what is the value of hope?
Yeah.
Well, there's so much to say what the value of hope is. What, you know, it's what's the value of despair that is more a question.
Okay, I'm not suggesting that people live in a land of despair, but actually in a land of realism.
Yeah, I'm a very hopey, changey person. And I think there's a lot of positivity in the world that we can go on with. But at the same time, I do agree with you that one should live in reality. You know, you root yourself in reality, but you also hope that by using hope, it propels you to do something and to motivate you to continue. I don't know, when you were talking about the example of America, I think it's a little bit simplistic to boil it down to the notion of, you know, a slogan being abstract and therefore it affects millions of people. And right now it's a verb that it's affecting, you know, less than half of the popular vote, but still put people in place. I think it's a lot more complex than that.
Okay.
Yeah, with hope, sometimes, you know, if you're considering it in a mental health situation, it is the only one thing that, in some cases, drives people to continue to live and to continue to do good and as firmly rooted in reality as possible.
I agree with you. I'm very easily persuaded. I agree with you, Gray, because it reminds me, actually, I mentioned earlier about football fans who support teams that consistently lose. In England, for instance, there's one thing which is very popular with fans out there of dreadful teams, is that while the game is going on, they'll start a chant which is, let's pretend we scored a goal. And then they just cheer as if they've just scored a goal. And all the players on the pitch have no idea what the hell's going on. But the fans are all jumping up and down to remind themselves, and hopefully to remind the team as well, this is what success feels like.
Mm.
Let's not lose hope, I suppose. Not lose the memory of hope. I've just argued myself back to a different position.
Well, I think we've kind of all sort of agreed with just about both. I mean, both of the positions, because the sort of binary of it is fairly clear cut, right? I would just like to add about the comment of America that I genuinely do have a friend. My oldest friend is, her name is Hope, and she lives in Canada. So I think maybe Cam, you know, if we want some reason for hope, looks like it's all in Canada.
Okay. I'm kind of like talking about the concept of hope. I mean, yeah, I'll meet her and I'll say, yes, hope exists. But, all right, another thing. And you, Anne Lee, you're from Sabah, but you're still Malaysian. And, but you've been away.
True Malaysian.
You're a true Malaysian. That's right. But you've been away a long time. So you've been in Indonesia and Singapore. So let me just explain that in Malaysia land, it's not a hope filled kind of land right now. It makes it hard, I think. I mean, I'm very much persuaded by Gray's argument about, you know, the hope is the thing that keeps you going. But it's, you know, sometimes it's damn hard to find elements, to find nuggets that are going to keep you going.
Yeah, I think particularly in the past, like, less than a decade or so, it's been quite doom and gloom in Malaysia, at least in certain sectors.
Yeah, we're talking sports, of course.
That's a very critical point.
Yeah.
In certain sectors. To certain people. I mean, we can't essentialize and say, or even Malaysianize or universalize, the idea that there is no hope.
I mean, I've had successes in some areas, but I'm talking about, you know, a cloud that hangs over a nation. What do you do?
Now you're putting me down, Cam. I'm like thinking about it. If it, yeah, of course, if we're talking about a macro and a larger picture, yes, you know, it have felt that it's not progressing as much. But again, you know, because I'm such a hopey and changey and positive person, I find little nuggets and areas where I would feel that there is a change for the good.
Yeah.
Whether it's with people who I notice in my circle. And of course, you know, when you look for good things, you attract more good things to come to you. At least I feel that that's how the universe works for me. Mm. I see a lot of changes and good changes in, like, you know, fellow Malaysians helping out fellow Malaysians, people coming in solidarity for issues that really matter, you know, people going down to the streets to protest for the kind of things that they believe in, even with their fellow humans who are not necessarily Malaysians, you know, fighting for migrant issues, refugee issues. So I think I choose to see the more positive side of things. Yeah. And that's what sort of heartened me more. And I see that at least, you know, in the everyday normal people on the streets, there's hope. Yeah. Maybe not so much in the corridors of power, you know, we all know about that. But I suppose it's where you would want to find and look for these things. So, yeah, I'm a hopey, kind of like changey person.
Gray, if you'd managed to say all of that in a more kind of Barack Obama kind of voice, I'd be all like, yes, we can. Okay?
Yes, we can.
Right? And actually, I'll wrap this one very quickly. But this was prompted actually by you, Anley, because your PhD thesis is why are there outbreaks of satire? Uh-huh. And I was thinking that it's because of hope. I think that there are times you can look at them historically when, say, Britain in the 1960s, when satire became a thing, is when there were times when people actually believed, hey, we're on the cusp. We could do something here. We can change things. And I think that Malaysia, say, in the 90s had that feeling. It's very hard to create satire when the information appears to be going against you.
The problem with satire is that it's, you know, it has no allegiance. So right wing or left wing, you have satire. You will have satire about somebody who doesn't believe in hope, for example. You will have some satire about somebody who doesn't believe in despair. And then I don't think that you can say that outbreaks of satire occur. Well, this is what I'm trying to discover, but I don't think it's only
one thing or another.
It is of course complex. But one of the things I think that would agree with you around is naivete. This is one of my kind of things, that there's a certain sort of naivete around satire, even in the function of a joke. You know, you have the setup, which is a sort of innocence, and then, boom, the punchline is to turn it over.
Right.
So the innocence or the idea of something kind of being there that needs to be disrupted or I mean, that's what a satirical sort of instinct does. Right. It just looks to disrupt.
So satire breaks out for all sorts of strange reasons we know not what, much like this skin rash that I just can't seem to shake off. But aside from that, I would say, okay, Gray, I'm with you. Yes, we can. Hopey changey. Let's do it.
I seriously thought that when you suggested a topic, it has something to do with Star Wars, but I guess it's not.
No.
You started off with sort of Star Wars or something. No,
Star Wars-y,
why would anyone watch something called what?
Wrath of the Titans. It
was there in
Kings
front of me.
Kings and Generals.
It was there in front of me and I was watching it and it was just like, this is awful.
Umar would definitely chastise you for watching that.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so that brings us to the end of our topics, but we now move on to the final part of the show, recommendations, where we recommend something we think of interest, and Gray Yeo is going first.
Yes, in line with my topic, I would like to recommend people to go and find, whether it's on Facebook or YouTube, Vox Media, V-O-X, and look for the short video encyclopedias that they've produced. I think I've watched almost 20 of them now, and I find them so fascinating because, again, they're really sleek, really graphic heavy, but also quite succinct and compact, and you might just learn something for you to carry on to the new year.
They're intelligent.
Very intelligent.
I've been clickbaited into those many times, and I've enjoyed them each time. Anne Lee?
I would like to recommend Jit Murad Plays. Mm. It was just recently launched at the Georgetown Literary Festival. It's published by Matahari Books, and it's really a much anticipated anthology of work that was written and performed throughout the 90s and 2000s. And he is, I would say, you know, any attempt to sort of write a history of Malaysian or even Southeast Asian plays without at least one of these would be remiss.
Well,
of,
that would be, Jit Murad.
Yeah, because it's especially, you know, his work is especially funny. His work is especially moving and poignant. And it's a trick, of course, as to how you read a play, right? Mm. It's the exact opposite of going to a quiet corner in the room and just reading it. You have to be all the voices.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's a great writer. He's our Oscar Wilde, really, I think, in one way. Yeah. He's
Can I ask
full of hope in a very dark way.
Yeah. Can I ask a quick question? Which one was your favourite Jit Murad plays?
Well, I think the last one. I have a deep connection to the first one. But the last one is Spilt Gravy on Rice. Mm. And I think that is his most accomplished play.
It's a film which will be released, I think it's going to be coming up this year. I'm not really sure, but there is a film out there. Next year, 2018. So that's, the book is actually called The Plays Of, is it?
No, Jit Murad Plays. He chose it. So it's, you know, not Jit Murad's Plays, Jit Murad Plays.
Very good. And it's just become available, and it's a great anthology. And it'd be really nice to see people who don't know Jit perform these plays.
Yeah, that's, now they can.
Yeah.
With this.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, so my recommendation is something I found. It's a documentary I found on the internet just by chance the other day. I saw it and I thought, oh, okay, I'll watch that. And it was fantastic. It's called Dawson City, Frozen Time, made by an American documentary filmmaker called Bill Morrison. It's about, inspired by the discovery of all these really old silent movie reels of film found in a place called Dawson City, way out in the middle of nowhere in Canada. That city was so far away that it was the end of the line for film distribution. So the films, when they got to Dawson City, had nowhere else to go. Mm. So the cinema owners there just kept these films. And they were made with a type of film which is being replaced, but it was very dangerous. It could just spontaneously combust. Mm. And eventually they buried all these reels because the studios didn't want them back. They had nowhere else to go. They just buried them. And many years later, decades later, these movies were rediscovered when some construction work was being done. So this filmmaker then has made a documentary, which is, it's like a silent movie in a way. It uses the same techniques of intertitles, so it's just words and then the films. And by using that, it tells the story of gold, because Dawson City is there because of the gold rush, of mining, of the late 19th and early 20th century. It's just a fabulous film. It's a great piece of storytelling. And I would say that if you are Malaysian and if you want to find a good evocation of mining and the impacts of mining, because KL and the whole of the peninsula is here because of tin mining, mm-hmm. if you watch this movie, although it's about gold mining in Canada, it's really essentially the same story. And young men going there and discovering the same things, creating the same things that young men when they came here did. So it's a fabulous film. It's called Dawson City, Frozen Time. Really good. You got to stick with it. It does require a bit of patience, but I loved it so much.
Can I ask a question? What's happening at Dawson City right now?
Well, at its peak in say about 1895, the population was something like 50,000. Now it's down to like 1,000.
Oh wow!
So there's not much happening there, but the gold mines are now pretty much defunct, but I think you have a handful of people who are just prospecting on their own, and not much is happening there. I think it's maybe tourism. Who knows, really? In a hope-changing kind of optimistic kind of way, it's the best thing that's happened to me in a long time, is watching this movie. So that brings us to the end of this week's show. Only remains me now to thank special honored guest, Anne Lee.
Thank you, Cam.
Grey Yeo.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Uh-huh. And myself, Cam Rusland. Please like our Facebook page. And so please join us also next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Get to Old Navy for star-spangled style. Right now, everything's on sale, up to 60% off. That's right, get everything from tees, shorts, dresses, and swim, all at 60% off. Now till July 7th at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Valid through 7/7, select styles only.